I'm Joanna Hillman. I work in the laboratory of Michael Higgins, who has published a lot of research on genomic imprinting in the past. I don't actually study imprinting anymore. I did when I first came here. My focus has kind of shifted, but I've always found it very interesting. So I'm going to go ahead and give you the lecture. And this is actually kind of branching off of the epigenetics lecture that Dr. Smerlia gave you, because imprinting isn't possible without DNA methylation and histone modification. So we'll go ahead and get started. So we're going to be talking about mammalian genomic imprinting, and we will also talk about its relationship to cancer. In the start of this, I like to say moms and dads' genes are not created equal. Has anybody in here ever heard of genomic imprinting? Yeah, okay. I know when I first came here, I hadn't heard of it, and it was very confusing. So today, our objectives are first to define simply epigenetics and genomic imprinting, talk about the discovery and how it was discovered that moms and dads' genes are not created equal, then what is the imprint, the life cycle of the imprint, DMRs and ICEs, which stands for differentially methylated regions, which you might have heard a little bit about last time, and imprint control elements, the two main mechanisms of imprinting, which are the insulator and the long non-coding RNA models, and genomic imprinting and how it relates to cancer. So you already know quite a bit about epigenetics, I would assume, but just a simple definition is that it's the study of mitotically or meiotically heritable changes in gene expression or cellular phenotype caused by mechanisms other than changes in the other underlying DNA sequence. So epigenetics doesn't have to do with the underlying DNA sequence. You can find different definitions of genomic imprinting in different reviews, on Wikipedia. And basically, it's just that your genes are different, the expression of your genes are different, whether or not they're coming from your dad or your mom's genome. So here's just the Wikipedia definition: an epigenetic process that can involve DNA methylation and histone modulation, like I said before, in order to achieve monoallelic gene expression without altering the underlying genetic sequence. So monoallelic means from one allele. So here is a really good pictorial representation of genomic imprinting. It defies the typical Mendelian genetics that you hear about, where you have a gene that comes from mom, a gene that comes from dad, and both of them have an equal likelihood of being expressed, or they're both expressed. And when both of the alleles from mom and dad are expressed, this is termed biallelic expression. But in genomic imprinting, you can either have maternal-specific or paternal-specific expression. So you can see here you only have one copy of this specific gene, and it can be either from the mom or the dad. So some important terms to know before we go ahead and get into the lecture. I know you probably already know some of these, but haploid is meaning that it contains only one set of chromosomes. Diploid contains two sets. Biallelic expression, like I said, a gene is expressed from both mom's and dad's alleles, and this is how most genes are expressed. And monoallelic expression, which is how imprinted genes are expressed. And then a differentially methylated region, like I mentioned earlier, where it's methylated on one allele and not the other. So just a little brief introduction to imprinted genes. They are present in placental mammals, so they evolved with the placental mammals. They're absent in egg-laying mammals. They're involved often in growth regulation and development, so that's really important. Maternally expressed genes are often growth suppressors, and they can be used as tumor suppressor genes in cancer. And paternally expressed genes are often growth promoters, so they're like proto-onco genes. And imprinting status actually varies between tissues, developmental stages, and species, but we won't get too much into that. So you have to wonder, why would imprinting have evolved? I mean, we have this beautiful thing where you have two copies of a gene, and if one gets turned off, you still have that other one to kind of back you up. So why would they have this mechanism where you only have one, so if you lose it, they're both gone? There's a couple hypotheses for this, but it's not exactly known yet, so I'm going to go over the two hypotheses. The first one is the parental conflict hypothesis, and this just suggests that embryonic growth is dependent on the mother but influenced by both the mom and the dad. So because paternal-specific genes are growth promoters, and maternal-specific genes are growth suppressors, this makes sense. So the father, because most animals are fertilized by multiple males, the father wants his offspring to the fitness of his offspring to be maximized. So the mother, she is really worried about all her offspring. So she wants equal distribution of resources to all her offspring. So this would predict that paternally expressed genes would promote growth and maternally expressed genes would slow it down, which is exactly what we see. And this prediction mostly holds true. One good example is the IGF-2 gene, and this is a paternally expressed gene, and if it's defective, there's over 40% reduction in growth. And this is kind of just a reiteration of what I just said. The IGF-2 gene and its receptor IGF-2R are actually opposite imprinted. IGF-2 is paternally expressed, IGF-2R is maternally expressed, and IGF-2R is a growth suppressor. So it makes sense for the paternal conflict hypothesis. One caveat of this hypothesis is that imprinting occurs even in monogamous species. So it doesn't really make sense in this context that a monogamous species, a male, would want imprinting because they aren't worried about other males fertilizing the female. The second hypothesis, which is a little harder to explain, is the trophoblast defense. And this suggests that the maternal genome is at risk because she's equipped for internal reproduction. So there's something called spontaneous oocyte activation that can happen where you don't need the male and the egg goes on to be activated without fertilization from the male. And the males don't have this problem. So imprinting silences genes on the maternal chromosome that promote placental development. So that's one thing we talked about. Imprinted genes are often associated with embryonic growth and development. And it also there's also activated genes that limit placental development. And the genes that are necessary for the placenta to connect to the uterus are only expressed from the paternal genome. So they're thinking that perhaps imprinting developed or evolved in order to protect the female from this spontaneous oocyte activation. But neither of these hypotheses have actually been proven. They're just hypotheses. It isn't really known yet why it evolved. So one important point that kind of gets missed sometimes is that genomic imprinting affects both males and females equally. It doesn't really have anything to do with the sex of the offspring. It has something to do with parental inheritance, which alleles are being inherited. So the same genes are on or off, whether you're male or female. Does that make sense to everybody? Just want to make sure that's clear. So the discovery of genomically imprinted genes, how did scientists figure out that there are these genes that are expressed only from the mom or only from the dad's alleles? So one big experiment that was done that showed that there was an inequivalence between the maternal and the paternal genome was this hairpin tail mouse model. So in this model, they did a large deletion of chromosome 17. And they were actually using this to prove the opposite of what they found. They wanted to prove that an organism heterozygous at a given locus is phenotypically identical whether the gamete is from the mom or the dad. But what they found was that when they deleted this region on chromosome 7 from the maternal allele, the mice were larger and they had mid-gestation lethality, meaning they died during development. But from the paternal allele, they saw no problems. The mice were viable and fertile. So they realized, well, there must be a difference between the maternal and the paternal chromosome, at least at chromosome 17. Another set of studies that they did were uniparental disomies, where they did translocations and they gave two copies of a chromosome from one parent and none from the other, so they did this with multiple chromosomes. And they found that in a normal circumstance, you have a viable mouse, you have, you know, one copy of the chromosome from mom, one copy from dad, everything looks good. You can see these top two and these bottom two are biallelic genes, just normal genes. This gene in the middle represents an imprinted gene expressed from the mom, not from the dad. In maternal uniparental disomy, you have two from the mom, and now you're having this gene expressed in a double dose. And this is lethal. And then when you look here and you delete, so you could do it either way. You could do a complete UPD, or you can do a deletion of just a specific gene. So in this case, they deleted this gene on the maternal allele. So now they had no copies at all, because it's already turned off on the dad's allele because of genomic imprinting. And that was lethal. And then you can see here if there was a polymorphism. So now the mom is expressing and the dad isn't expressing. It's still viable. So they did all these experiments. They weren't actually looking for genomic imprinting. They just kind of fell upon it. They realized that, wow, there must be a difference between the paternal and the maternal chromosome, because if it comes from one or the other, we're getting different phenotypes. And then the final experiment I'm going to talk about is the nuclear transfer experiments, where they took a female pronucleus and they injected either another female pronucleus, so they first took out the paternal one and injected another female one, or they took out both and injected two paternal pronuclei. And they found that this gynogenetic, or both from the female, was lethal, and the androgenetic was lethal as well. So they needed both. They needed the mom's and the dad's genomes in order to make a viable organism. Another interesting discovery from this study was that the two parental genomes actually seem to provide reciprocal functions. So when you have this gynogenetic, or both from the female to female pronuclei, you get the embryo, you get basically pretty good embryonic development. But the trophoblast, or the placental extraembryonic development, is very, very messed up. You don't get much of a placenta at all. But the opposite holds true when you look at the two paternal pronuclei. So they get really good placental development, but the embryo doesn't grow very well, suggesting that the paternal genome is involved in extraembryonic growth and the maternal genome is involved in embryonic growth. And that kind of goes back to the hypotheses we talked to in the beginning, the parental conflict hypotheses, because the dad is wanting to push up the fitness of his embryos. So two interesting syndromes that happen when there's a defect in imprinting are Prader-Willi syndrome and Angelman syndrome. So these two syndromes actually happen on the same exact region of chromosome 15. The same exact genes are disrupted, just depending on whether the disruption or the deletion occurs on the chromosome that was inherited from the mom or the chromosome that was inherited from the dad, you get a completely different syndrome. So here's just an example of the phenotypes that you see. You can see here, Prader-Willi syndrome was genes that were lost on the paternal chromosome. So you have two maternal. And then Angelman syndrome, the genes were lost on the maternal chromosome. So it's a completely different syndrome, exactly the same genes, except coming from the different allele. So is everybody clear up until now? I know we've just been talking about, you know, the history and basics, but I just want to make sure everybody's clear before I go ahead. We're good? Okay. So how are these imprinted genes silenced? How are you having no expression from one allele or another? Well, that would be DNA methylation and histomodifications are actually involved in this as well, but the big one is DNA methylation, and this is seen in differentially methylated regions in the genome. And something called imprinting centers or imprint control elements, which are actually the same exact thing. They're just termed differently in different literature that you read. are involved in this as well, and they often contain a differentially methylated region. So an imprint control element or imprint center is the same thing, and it often contains a differentially methylated region. So here's just a very basic example of how imprinted genes are silenced. Some of them have direct DNA methylation. So this gene here has DNA methylation, and therefore it is not on. And on the other allele, there's no DNA methylation, and it's on. So this is a differentially methylated region. One allele is methylated, one allele is not. One is on, one is not. So pretty simple and straightforward. So in this example here, they're saying the mechanism, the methylation is interfering with transcription factor binding. And then this actually isn't important for what we're talking about today. So the imprint control element is really important for genomic imprinting, which, I mean, just in the name you can tell, imprint control element. And like I said, it often contains a gametic differentially methylated region, which just means that this differentially methylated region was also present in the gamete. It can control expression of one or more imprinted genes in a cluster. So we'll talk about in a couple slides that imprinted genes often occur in clusters or multiple imprinted genes right next to each other. And it's often associated with a long non-coding RNA, and it's often found in the promoter of that long non-coding RNA. So if you want definitive proof that something is an imprint control element, if you knock it out and you lose imprinting of one or more distant genes, then you have proof that it's an imprint control element. And this is how a lot of these studies have been done. So like I said, imprinted genes are often clustered in the genome on different alleles. There's a bunch of imprinted genes right together. So this is just showing that you have your ICE here that I was talking about, the imprint control element, and then you have your multiple protein coding genes, and then you have, in the protein coding, this is actually standing for imprinted gene, IG. And then there's also, which is quite interesting, within these clusters, a lot of times there are non-imprinted genes, and it's not really known how these genes escape the imprinting. And then the non-coding RNA right here, it's just showing that there is a non-coding RNA in this cluster. So in this situation here, you have the maternal allele up here, the paternal allele down here, and for this specific cluster, the imprint or DNA methylation is on the maternal allele. And this kind of turns off expression of this non-coding RNA in this case. And we'll get into more specific examples in the next slides that'll make it a lot more clear. So because this region here, this ICE, has methylation, this non-coding RNA, it can't be expressed because this ICE is actually in the promoter of the non-coding RNA, and I know this isn't very clear from this picture. But because this isn't on, now these genes actually can be expressed. So all these protein coding genes are on, but the ICE is methylated or imprinted. And the opposite holds true on the paternal allele, because the ICE here doesn't have an imprint, it doesn't have DNA methylation. So therefore, all these genes are off because in this circumstance, this non-coding RNA is coming through and somehow turning these genes off. So I think this is basically saying the same thing. You know, on a non-imprinted chromosome, if you delete the differentially methylated region, which is in the ICE, on the chromosome with an imprint, there's no change. But if you delete the DMR on the chromosome with the imprint, the expression resembles the imprinted chromosome. Let me explain this a little better. So the chromosome with the imprint is the one that has the methylation, and the one without the imprint doesn't have the methylation. So you can see here, there's an imprint, and you can see here it's deleted. But considering it's deleted, and there's an imprint anyway, all these genes are going to be on, because this is already off. Does that make sense? It might not make any sense. So we have here
doesn't really matter in this circumstance, has the imprint, it has DNA methylation. So therefore, this, say this is a non-coding RNA, this promoter, who's the speaker that NC stands for non-coding RNA, it's off. So because this non-coding RNA, it has methylation, now all of these genes that are imprinted can be expressed. Because this can't do its thing. It can't come over and do its thing for these. So these are allowed to be expressed. If you delete that, it doesn't change anything. If you delete the region with the imprint, it doesn't change anything because it's already off. So it's just trying to explain how the imprint works. But if you do the same thing in a non-imprinted chromosome, you actually get the opposite effect.
And hopefully this becomes a little more clear when I go into the specific examples about the specific chromosomes that are imprinted. And if it's not clear by that point, just ask me. So how do these imprint control elements regulate imprinted genes? There's two different models that have been proposed and actually have been studied and proven for a lot of the imprinted clusters. The insulator, otherwise known as the enhancer blocking model, and the non-coding RNA model, or long non-coding RNA model. And often both of these can work on the same cluster, but I'm going to talk about them on two separate clusters. So the first one that I'll talk about is the insulator or enhancer blocking model. And a protein that's really important in this model is CTCF. And CTCF is a highly conserved 11 zinc finger protein. It uses a combination of these 11 zinc fingers to bind to thousands of regions throughout the genome. It is involved in transcriptional activation, repressing, silencing, and chromatin insulation. It's been shown to be involved in chromatin looping, but for our purposes, it's acting as an enhancer blocker. Do you guys all know what an enhancer is? Yeah? Okay. So one good example of this insulator model is the IGF2 cluster that I kind of alluded to in the beginning. So we're just going to orient ourselves here. Here's the maternal, and here's the paternal allele. So in this specific cluster, this IGF2 cluster contains something called H19, which is a non-coding RNA, and IGF2 and INS2. So on the maternal allele, you also have this enhancer over here on the other side of H19, downstream of H19. So on the maternal allele, you have CTCF binding to the imprint control element. On the paternal allele, you have DNA methylation, or an imprint at the imprint control element. Because of this DNA methylation, CTCF cannot bind. So that's really important to know. So on the maternal allele, because CTCF is binding, this enhancer cannot interact with INS2 and IGF2, but it can interact with H19. And I know this seems really simple, it's just kind of blocking it, but what actually happens is the chromosome comes and loops on itself, and that's CTCF is what helps do that. But for our purposes here today, the enhancer is blocked because CTCF is doing something to block it. But on the paternal allele, because of this DNA methylation and lack of CTCF, the chromosome can't loop, and therefore this enhancer now has access to IGF2 and INS2. And by some unknown mechanism, this methylation found on the imprint control element actually spreads to the H19 non-coding RNA. So on the paternal allele, you don't have any expression of H19 either. So the second model, do you have any questions on that model before I go ahead? Yes, go ahead. So the what is? Yeah, so the enhancer can actually enhance or activate both these genes and this non-coding RNA. In this case, on the maternal allele, it's able to interact with H19, and that's because there's no methylation here to spread to H19, and H19 can be expressed and enhanced. In this case, the enhancer can't work on it because it's methylated, because methylation kind of circumvents any work that the enhancer can do. It's blocking it. So So yeah, the enhancer works on all the genes in the cluster, just in different ways depending on what allele you're looking at. So another method of genomic imprinting is this long non-coding RNA model. A long non-coding RNA is a non-protein coding transcript longer than 200 nucleotides. There's a lot of different long non-coding RNAs. We'll just talk about one cluster today to keep it kind of simple. But the exist long non-coding RNA is one interesting example that's involved in X chromosome inactivation. So that's also a type of imprinting because you only have one X chromosome active. The ARN long non-coding RNA at the IGF2R locus, and the KCNQ1-OT1 long non-coding RNA at the KVDMR1 locus. And that's the one that our lab had studied quite extensively. Let's see. So I guess I have two examples here, and they basically work the same way. I'll go over both of them just to kind of reiterate the long non-coding RNA model. But first, this IGF2R cluster we'll go into, and that works with the ARN long non-coding RNA. So you have your maternal allele and your paternal allele, and I believe that this is the same. This is in the paper that was assigned to you if you need to look back at it. But on the maternal allele, you have methylation at the imprint control element. Because there's this methylation, this long non-coding RNA, so the promoter, in this circumstance, the promoter of the long non-coding RNA is actually right within this imprint control element. So when it's methylated, this gene is turned off. So methylation keeps this gene from becoming expressed. So because this gene cannot be expressed, these mRNAs can be expressed. So in the long non-coding RNA model, the long non-coding RNA comes and it represses genes. So when long non-coding RNA is on, protein coding genes are off. And see, the opposite is true on the paternal allele. Because you don't have methylation, now this AR long non-coding RNA is on, and these genes are actually silenced. And if this picture gets a little confusing, you need to remember that there's always some genes within these regions that are not imprinted, so they may be expressed biallelically. So the KVDMR1 cluster works in basically the same way. You have this long non-coding RNA, and maybe this picture is a little bit better than the last one. But on the paternal allele, you have this KCNQ1-OT1. It is expressed from the paternal allele. There's no methylation on its promoter. And this also represents the ICE. You can see here these black boxes representing genes that are biallelic, that are not imprinted. And then the red and the gray boxes represent genes that are imprinted. So here on the paternal allele, KCNQ1-OT1 is on. Therefore, all these imprinted genes on the paternal allele are silenced, and they're silenced by KCNQ1-OT1. There's a couple different mechanisms that have been proposed for how this silencing happens, and I'll go into that next, but nothing that is definitive yet. And the opposite holds true, like we see here on the maternal allele. There's methylation at KCNQ1-OT1 promoter at the ICE right here. So that methylation turns KCNQ1-OT1 expression off. Now it can't go and do its thing and silence all these genes. So all these genomically imprinted genes are expressed from the maternal allele on this specific chromosome. So, like I said, there's a few different suggestions for how long non-coding RNAs are silencing these genes on the chromosome next to them. And it's kind of confusing, like how do they skip over the biallelically imprinted genes? So it's nothing is completely definitive, but there's been a couple hypotheses for it. They think that perhaps this non-coding RNA may recruit repressive chromatin modifier complexes. So as the non-coding RNA is being transcribed, polychrome group proteins can come in over the top of the genes that it's transcribed on. But as you can see here, that doesn't explain everything because KCNQ1-OT1 expression goes this way, but there's some genes over here that are also silenced, so it doesn't explain it completely. Another suggestion is that it may target the chromosome domain to a nuclear compartment devoid of RNA polymerase II and enriched in these polycomb group proteins. That doesn't really explain how these biallelic genes are expressed either, but it could have something to do with looping, and I know there's different regions within these domains that are POL2 positive and POL2 negative. Or simply the active transcription of the non-coding RNA through the domain could affect binding of other proteins to these other genes. So the next thing we're going to talk about, is everybody clear on that? Everybody, go ahead. Okay. So in this situation, it means that the genes are not expressed in this situation. And a lot of the terminology is really interchangeable too, so it gets a little confusing. But in Prader-Willi syndrome, the genes are lost on the paternal chromosome. And in this situation, it means that there's no expression. So you don't have expression from the paternal chromosome versus the maternal chromosome. All right, and I'll just go briefly into the life cycle of an imprint, because it does have a life cycle, and the way that genes are imprinted changes as development ensues. So you have imprint acquisition and erasure during all mammalian development. So you have your imprints present in your gametes. So your sperm and your egg have imprints, which are maintained after the egg is fertilized. But then once the gametes start to form in the next generation, they lose their imprints. So you have your gonad before sex determination, you lose the imprints because the mice need to anybody needs to reestablish new imprints. So if you're a female or you're a male, you're going to have different imprints that are going to be going towards your offspring. So whether a gene is expressed from the maternal allele or the paternal allele, it's going to be reset in these gametes to start over the cycle. Is that clear? Okay. Sometimes that can be a little confusing. And there's a more detailed description. You probably have it on the end. You don't need to know all those little details, but if you are interested, there's a more detailed map of that at the end of the lecture. So one big question is, how does the methylation machinery distinguish maternal versus the paternal allele? Like, how are these different? So you have different imprints, whether you have female-specific, if you have eggs or you have sperm, you have different imprints. So how is this methylation knowing where to go? So the parental alleles are differentially marked by DNA methylation during gametogenesis. There's been a couple different suggestions for how this happens. From this paper in 2013, they suggest transcription histone modifications and higher order chromatin, which is kind of the basic thing that happened in epigenetics. And then in 2014, a paper was published suggesting that variations in temperature can induce different allele-specific epigenetic modifications, and the gonads are particularly sensitive to this. So maybe there's different temperatures in the female versus the male. So now we'll get into genomic imprinting and how it can relate to cancer. So here's just an interesting thing about imprinting in the news. I think this was quite a while ago, but colon cancer, which is the third most deadly cancer in America, often has loss of imprinting of the IGF-2 gene, and this correlates with colon cancer. And they found that a potential blood test to actually screen for colon cancer based on this imprinting. So the result of this is that maternal IGF-2 gene is turned on. So now you have both the maternal and the paternal IGF-2 gene turned on, and as we'll talk about a little later, IGF-2 is a growth promoter. It's normally expressed from the paternal chromosome. Like I said earlier, paternal chromosomes are paternally expressed imprinted genes are often growth promoters, while the opposite holds true for maternally expressed imprinted genes. So some interesting examples. A hyatidiform mole, or a molar pregnancy, is caused by a sperm combining with an egg that has lost its DNA. So in this case, the sperm reduplicates, and then you have all paternal genome, and this causes hyatidiform moles. In the opposite, an ovarian teratoma, where you have all your chromosomes from your maternal origin, here's a picture of that. It's kind of interesting. Sometimes you get teeth in these tumors and all sorts of different things. So these tumors, basically, from years back, before they even know about genomic imprinting, it kind of shows that there's an imbalance between the maternal and the paternal chromosome, and that can cause different types of cancer. Just some really quick examples. When they engineer mice to be imprint-free, those mice are very tumor-prone. You have normal imprinting of certain genes disrupted in tumors, like we said, for colon cancer, IGF-2 in this case. And then one really interesting syndrome that my boss studied a lot is Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, which is a cancer predisposition syndrome. Often these children will get kidney cancer. And this results from abnormal expression of imprinted genes on chromosome 11, which is that KVDMR locus. So I guess this is just reiterating what I said again, just in a pictorial format, so maybe it's easier for you to understand it, but you can get carcinogenesis if you get loss of imprinting of tumor suppressor or growth promoting genes. So loss of imprinting can mean that both genes are expressed from both mom and dad's allele, or it can mean that neither of them are expressed. So loss of imprinting is kind of, it can mean both things, it just depends on what's happening. So IGF-2, like I said, is a growth promoter. It's expressed from the paternal allele, therefore it is repressed on the maternal allele. If you lose imprinting of IGF-2, in cancer phenotypes, this often leads to double doses of IGF-2. So you have expression from both mom and dad at this point. So this can happen in multiple ways. So this is showing how loss of imprinting of IGF-2 can happen via deletion of that imprint control element or via methylation of the imprint control element. So in this case, you have mom and you have dad, and you can see you get expression from one right here, but not the other. But in this case, when you lose that ICE, you can no longer get repression of these genes. Because I don't know if you can remember, but the other picture of this showed how that CTCF binds here, so the enhancer is blocked. But in this situation, the enhancer isn't blocked, so it's expressed now from both alleles. So it can happen by deletion of the ICE, like I just mentioned, or it can happen by abnormal methylation of the ICE, or otherwise known as the ICR. So this is where it comes in, where it gets a little confusing. ICE, ICR, ICE all mean the same thing. Imprint control element, imprint control region, or imprint center. It all means the same thing. So in this case, it's kind of just going back to that figure we saw in the beginning. On the maternal chromosome, you have CTCF binding to this ICE, otherwise known as H19DMR, differentially methylated regions. They're always found in the ICE. And these enhancers down here now cannot access IGF-2, so it's turned off. And the opposite holds true on the other chromosome. But if you have abnormal methylation at this region, now CTCF cannot bind anymore. So it's basically the same thing that happens when you have a deletion. There's there's no CTCF to block these enhancers, so IGF-2 can now be expressed from both mom and dad's alleles. So you have a double dose of this growth promoter. So another interesting transcription factor or protein that our lab studies is Boris, and it's also known as CTCFL or CTCF-like. It's a paralog of CTCF, and therefore it contains the same DNA binding site, and it can bind to the same region. So one interesting thing is that Boris is often expressed in many cancers, albeit at a low level. So Boris can kind of act just like DNA methylation did. Boris binds, so CTCF can bind in this situation. So now these enhancers, once again, CTCF isn't there to do its thing, to block this enhancer from interacting with IGF-2, so therefore it can interact and it can activate IGF-2. But you can see in this case there's no methylation, so it's not turning off H19. It's not spreading over to H19 like it does over here. This is just a list of the different tumors that loss of imprinting of IGF-2 has been seen in. So you can see there's a ton of different tumors where it's been found, and there's probably an even more than that now. So like I said, two copies of IGF-2, growth promotion, very bad. Another really interesting imprinted gene that's involved in cancers is CDKN1C, and this works the opposite of IGF-2. CDKN1C is actually a growth suppressor, and it's normally expressed from the maternal allele and repressed on the paternal allele. So instead of getting two copies like you do with IGF-2 in cancers, in this case you actually lose both copies of CDKN1C. So it can't suppress growth like it's supposed to. And problems with CDKN1C are found in this syndrome that I was talking about, this Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. And this is an overgrowth and cancer predisposition syndrome. And these children have an 1,000-fold increased risk to specific embryonal tumors, most notably Wilms tumor, and it's a kidney tumor. This is caused by an imbalance in the expression of one or more genes on chromosome 11. And chromosome 11 contains both that KVDMR1 cluster and this IGF2H19 cluster. So the main cause of Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome is overactive IGF2, overactive growth promoters, it's a overgrowth syndrome, and loss of this growth suppressor, CDKN1C. And over 50% of the cases are due to abnormal DNA methylation in these regions. Here's the clinical presentation of BWS. Often they get their internal organs growing outside their body. They have Wilms tumor, macroglossia, really enlarged tongues. The kidneys are much larger. The pancreas is much larger. And they also have these ear creases. So these children have a really hard time. So like I said, over 50% of the cases of BWS are due to hypomethylation or problems with methylation. So hypomethylation of KVDMR1 causes 50 to 60% of Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. And the children that have this are actually at higher risk of these abdominal wall defects that I showed here, this omphalocele. 15% are heritable, 85% are sporadic. And you don't need to know all the nitty-gritty details here. I think the most important point to take home is that hypomethylation of KVDMR1 is really the main way that BWS happens in these children. So here's just a pictorial representation of that. This loss of methylation, otherwise known as hypomethylation at KVDMR1, and how it causes BWS or Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. So in your normal circumstance, this is just the same picture as I've been going through over and over with this locus. You have your maternal allele and your paternal allele. On mom's allele, you have methylation. On dad's allele, no methylation. So because dad's allele doesn't have methylation at this ICE, which contains this long non-coding RNA promoter. This long non-coding RNA can now be expressed. Because it's expressed, all these genes are off. And the opposite is true on the maternal allele. But in BWS, you lose this methylation. So now you don't have methylation on mom or dad. So you have the same thing going on in the paternal allele. All these genes are off because KCNQ1021 long non-coding RNA is on. But now it's on from the maternal allele as well. So these genes are off on both alleles. And you can see here the big one, CDKN1C, this growth suppressor, is knocked down. There's no copies of it, and it's needed. So I guess that's about all I have today. These are just conclusions that kind of wrap up everything that we talked about. I'm not going to read through these. You can read through them yourself. Let's see. Oh, that's weird. I don't know what's going on. It's like, is that how your slides look? Are they like replicates of the same thing? No? Huh. Okay. I'm just hoping I didn't lose anything. And here's the helpful reading. I'm pretty sure Anand sent you this one. If you're still confused, you can either email me, and if I can't answer the question, I'll ask my boss, he knows. Or you can read this review as well, which is pretty interesting if you're interested in genomic imprinting. Here's my contact information and Dr. Higgins' contact information. I'm sure if you contact him, he would definitely get back to you. Here are just some practice questions that will help you prepare for the exam. Thank you.